Good morning, everyone. Good to see you. We resume our study of Isaiah, and I appreciate Rick teaching last week. And today our focus is on chapters 34 and 35. So if you turn there, just give you a little heads up. In a way, it's more of the same, but packaged in such a poignant and beautiful way. So there's that. Daryl, would you lead us in a prayer as we begin, please?
Our Father in heaven, thank you for this time we have together, for this time we have to study from your word and from the prophets. We pray that you will enlighten us during this class and help us to glean and understand things that you would have us to from the study here. We pray you'll be with Philip as he conducts the class and us as participants. We pray you'll be with the other classes meeting as well in this building and with brethren in other places also. Pray that all things will be done to your glory. In Jesus' name we pray.
So chapter 34 is about judgment. No shock there that we would encounter a text focused on God judging a nation or nations or a people. Chapter 35 is about redemption or restoration. Again, no shock there. And in a way, that is a really good framework for looking at all the prophetic works. It's not one that fits, it's not a one size fits all, but it's sort of like a hat or a jacket. You can sort of wear somebody else's hat or jacket a little bit. Their shoes, no, that won't work as easily. So they are a general fit for what's happening in the prophets, judgment or restoration or redemption. And that's what we see here. And that's, I want you to see that sometimes that is the challenge in reading the prophets. It's like you're trying to keep up with a pinball. You're trying to keep up with a ping pong ball. It's just darting about. But keep in mind, typically if there is a shift in the focus, a shift in the tone, a shift in the message, it's usually going back and forth between judgment and restoration, judgment and salvation, punishment and redemption. It's those two general categories. And we have a beautiful example of that in chapters 34 and 35. So let's start to look at that in chapter 34. Les, can you read verses 1 to 4 of chapter 34, please?
Come near, you nations, to hear and heed, you people. Let the earth hear and all that is in it, the world and all the things that come forth from it. For the indignation of the Lord is against all nations, and his fury against all their armies. He has utterly destroyed them. He has given them over to slaughter. Also their slain shall be thrown out, their stench shall rise from the corpses, and the mountains shall be melted with their blood. All the host of heaven shall be dissolved, and the heavens shall be rolled up like a scroll. All their hosts shall fall down as the leaf falls from the vine and as fruit falling from a fig tree.
All right. Thank you very much. We are accustomed, especially in this first half of the book of Isaiah, for Isaiah writing about some judgment pronounced upon a nation. Well, who is the recipient of the judgment here? In the first few verses? Nations, it's generic, isn't it? It's nations, it's not specific. Now, so much of our work in the prophets must include understanding the historical context. That is just one of the first heavy lifting chores you've got to do in a prophetic work. What's the historical context? When is this? Is this when Assyria is threatening Israel? Is this when Judah is being threatened by Assyria? Is this later on when Babylon is threatening Judah? Is this later on when the people of Judah have been carried into captivity? Is this even later on when the people have come back from Babylonian captivity? So those, in a way, those are the four big historical context questions. Oftentimes, it's hard to ascertain what the historical context is. And, you know, you're used to doing that chore, you know, when is this? And then you'll hit a text like this one, and you're like, okay, to what period is this applied? and it's not really clear. And that's on purpose. When is Jesus coming back to judge? I mean, that's a really big, important event. It would be good to know when, right? When is he coming? We don't know.
I don't think Jesus knows.
Right, just the Father. Right. That's right. Because you know what? When he's coming is not the point. The point is he's coming. And he's coming in judgment. That's all we need to worry about. And so, this is a text that bears out the point that what's most important about God's judgment is God's judgment. Not necessarily the winds and the particulars, but that he is the judge and that he is going to judge and why he's going to judge and what solicits his judgment and all those kinds of things. That's really what is critical. So when you run into something and you're like, okay, I'm confused when this is, it's okay. It might be with a little work, there's a way to figure it out, that there's some evidence you hadn't seen. But maybe you're not, the reader is not meant to know exactly when this prediction is going to be applied. Maybe the point is not when in the setting, but rather the what and the who. And the what is, there's judgment. There is vicious, extensive judgment. And isn't it wonderful early on a Sunday morning to read about corpses stenching, okay, and all that kind of thing. But this is heavy judgment coming, and it's at the hand of God. That's the point of this text. And that's what we need to camp on. That's what it's for. Now, look at verse 5 and 6. Verse 5 and 6. Can you read that for us, Hilton, chapter 34, 5 and 6?
For my sword shall be bathed in heaven. Indeed, it shall come down on Edom and on the people of my curse for judgment. The sword of the Lord is filled with blood. It is made overflowing with fatness, with the blood of lambs and goats, with the fat of the kidneys of rams. For the Lord has a sacrifice in Bozrah and a great slaughter in the land of Edom.
All right, thank you. Now, we've just seen how that this starts off as a judgment against the nations. And when you look at the Bible overall, and you ask the question, which nations are God going to judge? Which nations will God judge? The answer is all of them. All of them. There are no exceptions. But look at the shift here in verse 5 and 6. The shift is on whom? Edom. Edom. Hopefully one of the little takeaways this year in our studies of the prophets is that don't underestimate Edom in the Old Testament. Edom keeps popping up, especially in the prophets. So what's up here? What Edom again? What's going on here? The prophets Obadiah, Amos, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Malachi, and here Isaiah, on more than one occasion, all write about Edom. They all write about Edom's sins and God's judgment of Edom. And look at this judgment here in verse 5 and 6. How is this judgment depicted? It's similar to a what? What kind of act? A sacrifice. We're accustomed in the Old Testament culture to animal sacrifices. And the blood and the meat and the fat and different things done with it and the carcass. This is depicted as a sacrificial act of God. Of judging Edom. So, we know, and this is really very apparent in the book of Obadiah, and that'll come up on one of the Wednesday survey classes, Obadiah, and we've dealt with it a little bit on Wednesday nights already, that Edom's sin, in particular, regarding what? In Judah. And it had to do with the Babylonian invasion. Who remembers? So the Edomites, when Judah was down, And the Babylonians had invaded, and they were taking captives. And we know this took place over about a 20-year period. There were three waves of Babylonian invasion and taking captives and subduing Judah, and they would put different kings in and take spoils, and finally they got tired of it and wiped Jerusalem out clean. But while at some point in that, Obadiah piled on. And Obadiah took spoils from Judah. Sorry, Obadiah. Obadiah says Edom took spoils. Not Obadiah. Sorry, Obadiah. Bad-mouthing him. Obadiah says that Edom took spoils. And Obadiah said that Edom captured some of the fleeing people of Judah and turned them into the Babylonians. And I'm sure it wasn't a matter of being good citizens, turning the bad guys over to the authorities. You know they're cashing in. Because that's what happened in ancient times when one mighty nation overtook another. They would take them captives for the purpose of slavery. And slavery is always a commercial activity. It's always first a commercial activity, not a racial activity, especially in ancient times. And so the Edomites had taken advantage of Judah and mistreated them. But of course, they have a long history. If you want to know more about that, see Daryl. That the Edomites, because he did some work on that a few Wednesday nights ago, the Edomites and the Israelites had been at each other a long time. And they both had done things, pretty tough to each other. But that's the thing that God is holding them accountable for regarding their brother Judah. Well, what's the big deal about Edom? Because as far as nations go, it's a smaller one. It's one of the minor players in the Old Testament. It's not a major player. But what's happening here? Well, think about this with me. Though they literally had sinned against Judah, Edom is representative. Because the Edomites were descendants of whom? Esau. Jacob and Esau. Jacob, who becomes Israel, who fathers the nation of Israel. And there were two sons that came from Isaac. But it was Jacob, or Israel, that became the chosen one, not Edom. And that's spoken of over and over and over, including Malachi talks about that. So what's happening here? Well, let's go back to Jacob and Esau. Let's go back to the roots of it. Consider the two-brother conflict, which, by the way, happened several times in the Old Testament, a two-brother conflict or a multi-brother conflict. And here you've got that in the family of David. You've got that in the family of Israel. Okay, you got Cain and Abel at the beginning of the Bible. But Jacob and Esau, what was Esau's role in that whole drama? What kind of person was Esau? He was the firstborn, which meant he was supposed to what? Receive the blessing, and he had the birthright by right, and he's supposed to get the blessing because of that. The blessing that was promised started with Abraham on, God blessing him. So what kind of person was Esau? What did he do with his birthright? He sold it for temporary satisfaction. Now, Jacob was manipulative all the way through. He was manipulative with the stew, and he was downright deceptive when it came to the blessing. But Esau, and the Old New Testament emphasizes this, like in Hebrews chapter 12, Esau is considered to be a profane person. He went and married whom? Among whom? The Canaanites, which greatly troubled his mom and dad because that was sort of corrupting things. They should go back to the family and marry. I know that sounds really weird, okay, but you know, read the book of Genesis and you'll understand it. But to go back to their people and marry. And at every turn, Esau is just rebellious. And yes, he gets a raw deal. Jacob deceives the father and gets the blessing, but Esau was also a man who didn't cherish that place as the firstborn. And so, and Esau is just depicted as this worldly man. Now, Jacob was a worldly acting man too, in his deceit and manipulation. And of course, Rebecca is involved in that business too. She had a bad hand in it. But as you see the trajectory of Jacob's life, and hopefully this is something we'll get into next year. I'm sorry, the year after that, maybe. When you look at the trajectory of Jacob's life, Jacob, yes, started off as this manipulative deceiver toward his brother, but Jacob becomes what? He becomes deceived. And he becomes deceived as he becomes more and more a man of faith. And you see that Jacob is a man of faith. He completely sells himself out to the promises from God. He becomes God's man. Esau is not God's man. That's the point of the Old Testament. And so what I want you to see is that the Edomites, the descendants of Esau, are representative. Jacob or Israel, God's people. Esau and the Edomites, not God's people. That's the point. And so I would have you see that in chapter 34 here, that Edom is representative. It's Edom and everybody like him. And who's like Edom? All the nations of men. And so that's how I think we should see that. And the judgment here is placed upon them. And I think this point is further made in verse 8. Hilton, read verse 8 there, 34. Tack that on there.
For it is the day of the Lord's vengeance, the year of recompense for the cause of Zion.
Interesting language there. I just couldn't help but to think of that this morning. And I'm like, I can just see modern Israel lifting that verse for whatever they're going to be doing. Okay. They feel like they are vindicated to take vengeance on anybody. And that's how people are, especially people who get wronged. And Jewish people have been wronged. And so it's that idea of vengeance. But as you read the prophets, who's the one taking vengeance? Who does it really belong to? It's God. And so these texts are about God's vengeance. That's what these texts are about. Humans love to take vengeance, and they feel justified in taking vengeance. And sometimes humans are mistreated. But oftentimes when they're mistreated, they turn around and they add to the evil by taking their vengeance. And that's why God condemns it over and over and over. But look here closely. He says here, the Lord has a day of vengeance, a year of recompense for the cause of Zion. Zion is what? Jerusalem. But it's more than just the actual city. It's representative of the people of God. In Zion, though it is a description of Jerusalem, the city, Zion surely, but slowly but surely in the prophetic works, that term is transitioning to something spiritual. The messianic Zion. The heavenly Jerusalem, the Messiah's Jerusalem, which has nothing to do with geography. In John 4, Jesus made that clear. John 5 to the, one of those Johns, to the woman at the well. It doesn't matter whether you're in Jerusalem or not. John 4 or 5, sorry. Thank you, John 4. So Zion becomes spiritual, representing the people of God. And here, God is taking vengeance for Zion, for the cause of Zion. So God's going to take vengeance for his people. His people don't have to take vengeance for themselves. God's going to do it for the cause of Zion. And I think that's important. You know, we're having to go through these prophets so fast and Isaiah so fast here. Such a mammoth work. Isaiah is like a Bible within the Bible. It's just everything in it. But it's important to pull out things that are so general in principle. And this is important to note, that the vengeance talked about in the prophets is God's. And God will take vengeance for his people. We don't have to worry about that. Okay, so look at verse 9 to 15 as this judgment is further depicted. And look at the vivid way in which Edom is impacted. Ken, can you read verse 9 down to verse 15, please?
And the streams of Edom shall be turned into pitch, and her soil into sulfur. Her land will become burning pitch. Night and day it shall not be quenched. Its smoke shall go up forever. From generation to generation it shall lie waste. None shall pass through it forever and ever. But the hawk and the porcupine shall possess it. The owl and the raven shall dwell in it. He shall stretch the line of confusion over it, and the plumb line of emptiness. Its nobles, there is no one there to call it a kingdom, and all its princes shall be nothing. Thorns shall grow over its strongholds, nettles and thistles in its fortress. It shall be the haunt of jackals, an abode for ostriches. All wild animals shall meet with hyenas. The wild goat shall cry to his fellow. Indeed, there the night bird settles and finds herself a resting place. The owl nests and lays and hatches and gathers her young in her shadow. Indeed, the hawks are gathered, each one with her mate.
All right, thank you. Edom, oh, where is Edom? I thought I had a map here. I do have a map. Edom is located right here to the southeast of Judah. And as far as the way things go today, that area, which is really Jordan, modern-day Jordan, it is pretty desolate and it's pretty isolated regarding even Middle East events. However, Edom had an important role in this region in ancient times. Daryl, what was it?
It was one of the primary highways, I guess you would say. The King's Highway was a path from Mesopotamia to Egypt.
Okay, boy. Right. Good. See what happens when you teach something? You remember it. You really do. Okay. So, two main highways going between Mesopotamia and the Nile River Valley, which are everything in this area in ancient times. Nile River Valley, Mesopotamia, or the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley. Two main passageways. One is along the Mediterranean, called the Coastal Highway. The other one's called the King's Highway, which is here on this plateau here. It's very high elevation, but it's a plateau, so you can travel it very easily. Cut right through Edom. Edom had just situated itself, and as a result, it became prosperous. And what kind of structures did they build, Daryl? Because of their terrain and so forth.
The main thing that we had photos of was like the mountain fortress and kind of into lots of cliffs, and they kind of trusted in that terrain to keep them safe.
Exactly. So they built a lot of their impressive structures, including fortresses and palaces, in the cliffs of the rock, out of rock. It's always hard to take a high ground. Any kind of operation on the ground, it's hard to take a high ground. And if it's in the rocks, that's really hard. So Edom had this pride. Read the book of Obadiah and you see that. They thought nobody could touch him. We have a defense, nobody can touch us. They were wrong. Okay? So now we just have these images of the ruins and it's just rocks and nothing there. Rocks and nothing there. Look what we just read. So, this was a kingdom that had strongholds and palaces, fortresses, inhabited, as this text says, by princes. They had a ruling dynasty, and they had wealth, they had nobility. That's what wealth and organization usually produces in every ancient society and medieval society, a nobility class. However, look at the contrast in this reading. What does it say? What will they become?
Desolate.
Deserted. Overrun with what? Wild animals. And what are some of the wild animals, by the way?
Lions.
The what?
Lions.
May have been. Yeah. May have been in some places, yes. What else do you see?
Hyenas.
Jackals. Right. Ostriches. Some of the translations vary on some of this, like owls or tree serpent. It's hard to know in the Hebrew exactly what this is, but it's a bunch of wild animals, wild goats, etc. And it's also overrun by what? All kinds of thorns and thistles. Wow. Yeah, you're talking about in verse 14, night bird.
Oh, yours says bird.
Mine says night bird. I think that it's, I got a footnote that says uncertain. Okay. Bunch of wild animals. Put it this way, you don't want to, the noises at night would be pretty scary. Okay. Nobody around and all these noises. So it's eerie. English Standard even says haunts. It's like a ghost town. The picture is eerie, deserted and covered up with this growth and animals. And we've all seen places like that. We've all seen places that was a man-made structure that broke down or was abandoned, and then just wild things, vines and trees pop up and grows into it, and thorns and bushes, and then animals are everywhere nesting and hanging out in it. And it's such a judgment of the failure of man when you see that. What a vivid picture, Earl.
Very similar language to what Isaiah and Jeremiah said about the fall of Babylon.
Yes, yes.
It even today is desolate.
Yes.
Wild animals and such.
Another guy who taught something who's, you can't shake it after you teach it. It sticks with you. This is.
James says that highway is a highway of holiness.
Yeah, we're going to see that later on. Yeah, in chapter 35. Highway of holiness in 35. Yeah, that's the contrast from this to that. Okay? So, it's an eerie picture. And at one time, the Edomites could not even imagine their land would be like that. Us? No way. Again, we keep coming back to the idea of ruins. Ruins of civilizations. You need to take heed about that. Yeah.
I remember when we were studying that, I saw the terrain and I wondered, well, surely they must have had some fertile area in their territory. I suppose maybe they did, and now it's, more desolate than it used to be.
Yeah.
The reading of this is the way I...
Right.
Yeah. Farrell Jenkins, probably the brother that knows the most about this part of the world than any brother I know, he argues that he thinks the climate has changed since ancient times, that it's drier now than it was then. And he's not a climate change guy. It's nothing to do with that, okay? It's just that it's just different, okay? And it does appear even Israel itself is less arable than it was in ancient times. But Edom got its wealth through commercial activity, not so much crop production. Like Mesopotamia and Nile River Valley, they got it through crop production. So they got it another way. It's commercial, just like the Phoenicians. Phoenicians, we talked about them earlier this year. Very small country, really city-states, Tyre and Sidon, a couple of others. But it was moving goods, being the UPS and being the Amazon of the ancient world. The Phoenicia got stinking, nasty, filthy rich. And so Edom had a period there where they became prosperous because of trade coming through there and facilitating that trade. So, but boy, look what's going to happen to them. Taken down, hard, and all the way. Let's move on to 35. Okay, anything else on 34? We need to move on to 35. Good stuff. So, talking about a contrast. After such heavy, and watch for this as you're reading the prophets this year. Whenever you encounter some heavy, heavy prophecy of judgment, get ready for it. All of a sudden, you'll see a ray of hope shine in. You'll see some beautiful picture of restoration and salvation. And if you're reading some beautiful picture of restoration and salvation, just wait for it. Guess what's going to come around the corner here? Another punch of judgment passage. That is very much the case in a lot of these major prophets, but also the minor prophets too. A lot of the minor prophets, you'll see that. So, look at what happens here in chapter 35. Though God's faithful remnant will experience a degree of joy and glory after the nations are judged, like Babylon, Earl's referencing that a moment ago. And we're starting to see in the book of Isaiah, more and more in the latter part, prophecies that are getting them ready for captivity. Judah's preparation for their Babylonian captivity and beyond when they're restored. There is a degree to which there is going to be glory and joy when the people of Judah can come back to Judah from Babylon. But it is very limited. They are still going to struggle. And these kinds of depictions like we see in 35 really don't line up with their post-exile experience. And again, what Isaiah is seeing is something even not just past Babylon's, the captivity in Babylon, but even way past Babylon. So look here at 35. Read verse 1 and 2 for us. Would you read that, Earl? 1 and 2. 35, 1 and 2.
Wilderness and the desert will be glad, and the Araba will rejoice and blossom like the crocus. It will blossom profusely and rejoice with rejoicing and shout with joy. The glory of Lebanon will be given to it, the majesty of Carmel and Sharon. They will see the glory of the Lord, the majesty of our God.
All right, thank you. Now, it's hard to know because these are sermons placed into a book. And it's hard to know whether this sermon was preached the next week. Okay, just hang with me with that liberty. But for sure, when this was compiled, this prophecy was placed after the one we just read. And the one we just read was all about Edom being turned into a desolation. Just a deserted, desolate place. Well, here it starts off with a picture of a desert, a wilderness, but what's happening in it? I just saw this morning that evidently Death Valley and that area of Southern California has got some rain. What happens to a desert when it gets rain? This is remarkable. Things flower out. It's very isolated. It's not like a meadow like we have in this part of the world, but you'll see pops of things flowering. And that's the picture here. To a desert has come now nourishment. That's what Isaiah is depicting here. And then look at verse 3 and 4. Earl, would you read 3 and 4, please?
Encourage the exhausted and strengthen the feeble. Say to those who are with anxious heart, take courage, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance. The recompense of God will come, but He will save you.
All right, now we know from verse 2, 3, and 4 that what he's depicting here is not just a desert getting the occasional rainfall. This is all figurative language regarding the Lord coming and blessing, the Lord coming and saving. That's what it's describing. And look at verse 3 and 4. How is a resurgence of personal strength depicted? Because God's going to cause a blessing, okay? It's going to result in what? How is the depleted condition depicted? Verse 3, a person has what kind of hands? Weak or feeble hands. What about their knees? Feeble and weak, okay? What kind of heart do they have in verse 4? Anxious heart, a troubled heart. But what's God going to do to those hands and knees that are so weak? It's going to strengthen those, okay? And that heart, he infuses it with be strong and fear not, okay? Now, what is paired with these people who have weak hands and knees and their hearts are troubled? Look what it's paired with. What's the message they get in verse 4, at the middle of verse 4? What's going to happen? God is coming and he's going to do what? He's going to take vengeance. Watch how that over and over in the Bible, and the prophets very much so, that God's judgment is always paired with God's salvation. The same act judges some and saves others. I mean, everything, that happens with everything. The flood, the taking of the Canaan land, the deliverance before that from Egyptian bondage, even Christ and the cross. You're going to reject him? If so, you're going to be judged. He's going to be the stone of stumbling, rock of offense, or he's going to be the rock of your salvation if you accept him. And so it is with the coming of Christ too, in the second coming. So here it's paired with that. And I think it's right. according to this text and so many others in the prophets, that we as God's people long for His judgment. You know, we get aggravated at the way how evil flourishes. The solution to that is this. Strengthen your knees, your hands, and settle your anxious heart. Have courage, because God's coming. He's going to take vengeance. He's going to take care of that. Oh, God's coming, He'll take care of it. What about this? God's coming, He's going to take care of it. What about this? The Lord's coming, He'll take care of it. Well, when is He coming? How's it going to happen? That's not the question. Remember, we saw that in chapter 34. That's not the issue. The issue is who's coming and what's He going to do. That's the issue. And in that, God wants us to draw comfort. Beautiful text there. If they all are. And this is what Frank's getting at a moment ago. Look down to verse 8 and 9. Before we get to that, look at verse 5 and 6. I'm just going to have you glance at it. Glance at verse 5 and 6 and what is depicted. Now, it's not a desert blooming, but it's another depiction, verse 5 and 6. That kind of language depicting those things, where do we see that in the New Testament? In the gospel, Jesus, when John's disciples, John was struggling in prison, and he sends word, are you the one or do we look for another? These are the kinds of statements. It's found a few times in the prophets, at least two or three. This is the answer to John. And that is, the eyes of the blind are open, the ears of the deaf are unstopped. That's messianic. The Messiah will usher in that time. And He literally, and we'll see that connection in the sermon, He literally did give sight to the blind and hearing to the deaf. But of course, it's figurative language here, isn't it? What kind of blindness is God really concerned about? Spiritual blindness, the hearts and our minds, exactly. And that's the very point of why Jesus healed the blind people and the deaf people and the lame people. It's a spiritual message. It's figurative. He did it literally, but there's a figurative message there too. And then look at verse 8 and 9 there. Dave, can you read verse 8 and 9, 35?
And the highway shall be there, and it shall be called the way of holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it. It shall belong to those who walk on the way, even if they are fools, they shall not go astray. No lion shall be there, nor shall any ravenous beast come up on it. They shall not be found there, but the redeemed shall walk there.
Thank you. Again, though in time may not have been paired, but when they collect these prophecies, they put this one, say they, it was probably Isaiah, with this one right before, and look again at the contrast of Edom falling and things being corrupted by nature, and then the wild animals taking over, to this highway where there is no threatening animal there like a lion. See the contrast, okay, between the two chapters. A highway. Have we seen that expression before in the book of Isaiah? This is when we all go, yeah, we have. 11:16. And there will be a highway from Assyria for the remnant that remains of his people, as there was for Israel when they came up from the land of Egypt. Note how increasingly in the book of Isaiah, there is some kind of reference to something that sounds like the Exodus. It's like a second Exodus that Isaiah writes about. And is this merely the coming out of captivity back to the land one day? Only in part. Only in part. Also, 19:23 says this. In that day, it's almost always messianic. In that day, there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria, and Assyria will come into Egypt, and Egypt into Assyria, and the Egyptians will worship with the Assyrians. Whoa, what is that about? If the other one's about returning from captivity, this is about how the Assyrians and the Egyptians are going to get together, who were mortal enemies, But to get together for what? For war? For worship. Verse 24, in that day Israel will be the third with Egypt and Assyria. See, there's the Israelites and the Gentiles combined. A blessing in the midst of the earth, whom the Lord of hosts has blessed, saying, blessed be Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance. That's all messianic. All nations are going to come into Christ, into the Lord's house, Isaiah 2. Of course, if you're going to get somewhere, you got to take a road, right? You got to take a highway. You got to take a highway of holiness. And even if you've been a fool, according to this text, there's a way for you to stay on that highway. Haven't we all been fools? But out of God's grace, He's forgiven us. And so, wow, this is... If you don't think Isaiah is beautiful by this chapter here, I'm giving up on you. But I know you do. But it's just such a beautiful, such beautiful literature. But most importantly, from the heart of God. And the path to restoration is what this is. And what are some of the other characteristics of this highway in verse 8 and 9? No threat there. Got to become unclean. You can't be unclean. You got to become clean, exactly. And this is so Exodus-like. And just jumping ahead a little bit, we'll see this in a few weeks. In chapter 40... That starts off, comfort my people, speak tenderly, verse 2, verse 3, a voice cries in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God, a highway through the desert for our God. That's just like chapter 35. But who is this talking about? Isaiah 40, in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. Who would that be biblically? John the Baptist with Jesus coming, John preparing the way for him. This is messianic here in chapter 35. And look at the beauty of verse 10. And the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. Okay, thank you.